Well, it looks like long last summer is here. This morning, I think our subject may come very close to a number of personal problems in the lives of thoughtful persons. I mention the difference between a dedication and a commitment. Today in the world, we have approximately 2.25 billion committed Christians. They were either born in the faith or live in areas where it is the exclusive religion, or practically so, or have been converted in one way or another during the years of life. These persons have accepted the teachings of Christ, the immoral and ethical admonitions of both Testaments, especially the New Testament. Now, what are they doing? What are all these committed persons actually doing? I think most of them labor under a kind of misunderstanding that a commitment to a religion is one of the things that happens to people as they grow up, and they acknowledge, in a sense, the integrities of the faith that they have accepted. But these same people usually have very little change in internal disposition or quality. They continue to make the old familiar mistakes. They dislike all the people that they have disliked before. They follow all of the whims and fancies of society. And there's no doubt that among them we have a number of chronic alcoholics and also a large number of chronic complainers. These people wear their religion as a kind of overcoat or a vestment with a certain moral hope that it is doing something, but with very little definite effort to live the faith to which they have committed their lives. Now, to me, a dedication is rather a different thing. A dedication means that the individual, of his own free will and accord, has determined within himself a standard of life which he regards as proper to a human being and appropriate to the time and places in which he may dwell, and then settles down to the living of these convictions. Dedication leads to the acceptance of a way of life, whereas commitment usually merely means the acceptance of a belief as a kind of document, as a kind of credential, with very little intent to change the life that is within the person himself. Commitments bind from the outside, dedications from the inside. So today we are in a condition of society, both individual and collective, in which religion is becoming increasingly important to us. For a long time, in the gay days of so-called prosperity, we were not very religion-oriented. We wished to enjoy life to the fullest, and as far as possible, this mood still continues. But there are situations arising in which it is becoming obvious that we are in desperate need of some kind of internal strength. And when we look for this internal strength, we fail to find it in most cases, because it is something we discover, it's something we create by our own integrities. So I want to talk a little bit this morning about the integrities of dedication, the integrities of the individual striving simply and directly to live a better life, a life nearer to what he instinctively realizes to be the divine will. Of course, those who are of atheistic complexion are not too much concerned about this. But as conditions become increasingly acute, atheism has a tendency to fade out. It's very difficult to be atheistic when everything is in turmoil and all things go wrong. Atheism is a kind of a smooth acceptance of a way of life that does not require much explanation and is not attended by any outstanding hope for the future. Therefore, dedication is something that we must begin to work with seriously and with integrities. The dedication must really relate to the moral integrities of life. Dedications are present in all religions. The dedication pattern is nearly always referred to as mystical, a pattern of inward realities in which the source of inspiration arises from within the person, but is challenged through the beliefs of the faith to which he belongs. Every religion has its mysticism. The external or outside faith itself is a kind of discipline, more like a spiritual police force, which tries to prevent the individual from becoming a delinquent. The mystical type of person, however, is not concerned primarily with this. He is concerned, rather, with a great desire to be a positive factor for good in his world, and to realize within his own heart and soul that he was created for a purpose, and that this purpose must be fulfilled if he is to be happy himself or live in a well-adjusted civilization. So we start to consider what we are actually doing in the name of the faith that we belong to. Of course, the average person in the West is not too well acquainted with Oriental beliefs. Therefore, it doesn't occur to him usually to attempt a comparison with his Western convictions. For our purpose, therefore, we will remain largely in the Western theater, but we will remind the thoughtful person that every religion of importance that has ever existed in the world has also had a dedication level. It has had something which calls upon the individual to be something, that demands that he in some way earns the peace he hopes for, that he deserves the good toward which he looks so expectantly. The individual who has done nothing in his own life to deserve good may still, under a condition of commitment, believe he is entitled to certain privileges, the mere statement or commitment being an assurance of salvation. However, the missionaries that I've talked to, and I've known quite a few, tell me that conversions by means of missionary endeavors are very seldom permanent.
The individual, under an emotional glamour, makes a promise, and 5 weeks
later he has broken it, because he simply hasn't the strength to live up to the emotional pressure of a moment of contrition. He goes back again to his own ways. So the missionaries have developed cycles of return and visit the various areas where they have served once or twice a year, just to keep the people in line. Yeah, reconvert them, because the conversion is not long-lasting. Now, around us, we see today a world of people who have a religious conviction of one kind or another, and the world has never been in worse shape. It would seem that with all the years, the centuries that have passed under spiritual leadership and integrities and examples of high spiritual realities, that we would have a stronger foundation upon which to build our personal lives. But we do not have such a foundation. Our foundation is largely based upon the experiences we have dealing with the delinquencies of other people. We live in a kind of world in which we assume integrity not only to be rationally impossible, but economically disastrous. We live in a world in which the individual is forced by circumstances beyond his control to corrupt his own personal life for one advantage or another. This does not seem to be very reasonable, inasmuch as his temptations come from other members of his own faith, and whether he realizes it or not, he is very often contributing to spiritual disaster in the lives of persons around him. He does not seem to realize that his environment is composed of people, most of whom claim to believe the Ten Commandments. and very few of whom have gotten through life without breaking at least three or four of them. Therefore, we have this problem of why doesn't religion work? I've had a number of persons come to me recently to explain that they are disillusioned with religion because it doesn't work. That the individuals who have followed the gods of the past and their descendants are still in the same trouble they were in the dawn of time. Only the trouble is worse now because it is backed by tremendous scientific progress. Now, I've talked to a number of scientists, including several that were associated with the University of Berkeley, and most of these men are not really atheists. Most of them are husbands and fathers. They have children. They have family lives. And they really are at wit's end as to what to do about these things. One told me the only answer he had was to be a scientist 6 days a week and a religionist on Sunday. This doesn't work very well, however. Here is an inconsistency that is practically unsolvable. But almost everyone has sensed the need for some kind of spiritual integrity. They may experience the need first when others fail them, but it endures while they turn in their turn fail others. So we have to try to find out, if we can, why this condition exists, why it is possible for people to believe, claim, and affirm, legislate, and decree a high moral character and code and not be able to live to it. Well, there's many problems. One of the problems is levels. Persons of various degrees of intellectual or metaphysical study have certain beliefs. And these beliefs can be, and often are, backed by strong intellectual pressures. A great many persons build their religion upon a scientific basis in which the science, in turn, is brought into harmony with some spiritual dispensation. But the fact still remains that something has gone wrong. Something has happened which causes many people to say also that the past is dead, that the religions of the past never worked, and therefore there's no use trying to perpetuate them. Well, the more we look into history, we can take almost anything we want from the rise and fall of the Roman Empire down to Durant, and we will find that religion has not failed. The individuals have failed religion. There is nothing wrong with the creed. The only problem is that too many people do not wish to keep it. And the reason they do not wish to keep it is because it interferes with certain essentials of modern thinking. The individual must sometime decide between being honest and being rich. And under decisions of that time, it is very difficult for him to decide to remain comparatively poverty-stricken. The individual, therefore, has made up gradually a philosophy of life, which might well be termed a one-life philosophy. It is a belief in which everything is centered in one embodiment in this world. The individual is born, grows up, creates a career, retires, and passes on. This is the story of life. There is nothing more. Under this type of thinking, the importance of the moment is exaggerated. Wealth becomes tremendous because we are only here once to spend it. We only have a limited time in which to accumulate it, and then also a very limited time in which to enjoy it. And if we enjoy it too much, that shortens the time we have left. Little by little, it seems that to have it now, enjoy it now, and remain completely indifferent of all other factors is a proper intellectual approach to the problem of existence. Well, we look around us. If as a result of this one life concept, we had managed to create a world in which things were so beautiful that while we are here, we would live in a state of joy. It might be one thing, but even this life in which we are trying so desperately to be happy is ridden with nearly every imaginable infirmity. there is really no peace here for the individual who doesn't believe that there's any peace anywhere else. He decides that he is going from one infirmity to another. And little by little, the incentives to build a better life here are destroyed. The most common cause of this destruction, of course, is materialism. And another, almost equally disastrous one, is hypocrisy. We talk about certain things. We even support charities. We help the poor. We adopt the widow and the fatherless. But still, these things do not touch the inner part of our natures. They appeal to our generosity. We are good-natured, kindly, well-intentioned people. We would all like to live in peace. We would all like to have the simple joys of life. But one way or another, these things do not happen. And the only ones apparently who are happy are the ones who live in small communities away from the conflicts of civilization, and such retreats are now becoming few. Therefore, the actual problem remains as it has always been. Not that the ethics and integrities which have come down to us are wrong, but because they interfere with a peculiar level of our own ignorance. We do not realize them as realities. We recognize the foreclosure of the mortgage as real, but we think of the hope of salvation beyond the grave as more or less an illusion, a hope, or a hypothesis. Consequently, the real is now that which is seen and touched by the sensory perceptions. It is here and now, in the midst of problems, that we must face reality. And reality is something that calls upon the inner integrities of the person. After all, the very life that we have is loaned to us. It is loaned to us, and a heart in our own bodies beats until that loan is foreclosed. We are here under a lien or a loan. We are here to do certain things or achieve certain things or unloose certain parts of our own inner lives. We have, therefore, just this time, a so-called, to do something that is going to help, something that is going to solve problems for us. And the time comes in the chaos of things, when war after war and nuclear fear after fear must bring us to the realization that we are not doing it the way it should be done. Now, of course, to go out and preach this to the public isn't going to do much good, because individuals are all thinking in terms of now, and they are not realizing what tomorrow brings. So we have to recognize that the beginning of this dedication, this integration, is inside of ourselves. We must work it out in the privacy of our own hearts. We must decide within ourselves how we are going to live and why. Now, we are equipped with sufficient faculties to permit us to make these decisions. Why, then, are we in trouble in not being able to make a simple, honest decision concerning life? Well, one of the reasons we have this trouble is education. We are educated to live in a troubled world. It is assumed that in this world we will be born, grow up, raise families, establish careers, retire on Social Security, and finally have a $500 funeral supplied by the government. This is what we are finally taught. We are also taught, however, that in this situation, some people are going to do better than others, but better means more profitably. Some are going to have higher estates because they've had greater education. But all of this education, like nearly every other factor in our daily living, is geared completely to our physical life here, a life that goes only for 60, 70, 80, 90 years, and that's it. Beyond this, to the average person, there is nothing. Most individuals have lost the interest or lost any recognition of the idea of eternal perdition. We are not really awfully conscious of hellfire and damnation. This seemingly died along with the belief that there is no survival. All the way along, however, the problem continues to press in upon us. Some way in this confounded mess, as we may call it, there has to be some way of doing something right. We have to find out what are the real values that we should be trying to work with. Well, one way to be factual on this point is to study for a moment the various areas in which these values have failed because they were not properly implemented. We can produce millions of cases to prove that selfishness has failed, that corruption fails, that despotism fails, that terrorism fails, that dictators fail. All of these things we can find in the pages of history. On the other hand, everyone kind of has a feeling that maybe he's going to break the law of averages. His mistakes are going to be successful. It's now come down to the simple problem of narcotics addiction, in which these young people really know exactly what they are doing, but it doesn't mean anything to them. The reason being that a moment of exhilaration is more important than a lifetime of integrities. And as they do not believe in anything much anyway, or have lost that belief via the narcotics route, the individual will keep right on going when he has seen his own roommate drop dead. Nothing happens except the gratification of a moment of superiority, which isn't real, because it is nothing but a destructive force eating up our lives. So this type of impasse is getting to a point where we have to do something about it. Now we are told or affirmed that actually this is not the only life we have, that there is something that survives, and that that something that survives is far more important than that which does not survive. Now we can say that the belief in survival is an hypothesis, that we have no proof that it survives. And yet as we look through nature around us, we find everywhere survival. We find that everything is there for a purpose, that things work out incredible destinies. But we are not too much concerned with this type of thing. But if we begin to search inside of ourselves for something that will support us, beside merely wealth, which of course is one of the most insubstantial of all things, we will find that there are convictions down deep in us, convictions that are as deep as the beating of the heart, convictions that are as real as the circulation of the blood, predictions and suspicions and ideals within ourselves that came with us when we came and go with us when we go. And somewhere we must find an allegiance to these. We must find a way of building a permanent foundation upon internal realities as they bear witness to eternal verities. Unless we are able to make this adjustment, our lives are going to be just one common and continuous uncertainty. Now, where are we now in these problems? Most so-called civilized people today do not believe in crime. They do not believe in violence. They do not believe in wars and revolutions. They believe in a more or less just way of life. Yet these very people who are opposed to mass violence are not willing to establish patterns of conduct that prevent small areas of violence in their own environments. The individual who has not disciplined himself can be a center of violence in his own home. He can bring down the estate to which he belongs to ruin. He can dissolve the unions of affection and companionship simply because of the incredible self-centeredness of himself. These things have to change. We have to realize that we are here to outgrow the obvious, that we are here to prove that the inevitable failure is not inevitable. And the only reason it is inevitable in appearance is because we've never done anything to change it in a properly organized way. When someone comes along with a message that suggests a major change in policy, it is usually easier to get rid of this pioneer than it is to change our own ways. Nearly every one of the great teachers of humanity have been discredited. Many of them have been martyred, and most of them have been ignored. This is because they interfered with the individual doing the things that he shouldn't do. He was committed to an inconsistency of conduct, which must inevitably ruin civilization. We see this in our various religious groups. We see the result of the Inquisition. We see the failure of the Crusades. We find the murders and martyrdoms of our sages and our great leaders from back to the dawn of history, because they interfered with the right of the individual to be wrong. And it was easier to get rid of him than correct our own mistakes. Now, the same is true in a little different way today. We are not out murdering each other, in general at least, but we are in a condition in which we are looking for answers that enable us to do wrong, and we do it with a good hope and a great aspiration toward the future. In other words, we are looking now for the what we would consider the perfect religion, the one that gives everything and demands nothing. A religion that never fails, because no matter what happens, it is not going to succumb. We're going to do as we please and maybe go to heaven. This is a sort of a dismal prospect in many ways. It is certainly no challenge. It doesn't do anything to make us bigger or better people. It simply enables us to drift along until one of the terminal diseases catches up with us. And this is what is the general problem. But there are among people a limited number who are really desirous of finding answers. They want to do something in this world to really help their own growth and serve the needs of others. And Confucius was one of the great teachers of the past. Nobody murdered him. He finally, however, admitted complete failure, that no matter where he went, no one cared. But Confucius pointed out very definitely that all of the reforms of society must begin as seeds in the private lives of persons, that the great forest begins with a little seed, and all the great and joyous things of life begin with small, humble beginnings, which build and unfold and develop until they become the source of security for whole generations of people. So Confucius began his philosophizing not by saying the world should change, but saying, let me look at myself and see if I should change. See whether or not the individual himself is living a better life than his society. If it's not a little better, at least, he's in trouble. He is going to go through all the spiritual, moral, and economic bankruptcies that are afflicting this generation. So to begin with, we can put what we call our own house in order. And this is the beginning of a dedication. A dedication based upon the realization that we have all accepted certain responsibilities. These are commitments. But we must verify them and sanctify them by dedications. The vow of marriage is a commitment, but it is not necessarily a dedication. And our responsibilities to children, our responsibilities to society, are regarded as commitments that we must meet, but they all fail if they are not based upon dedications of the individual to the perfection and expansion of that which is right. So we are going to say, let's start with a small group, a group of persons, all maybe from one family stem. I know cases where the second and third generation has gotten together with the survivals of the first generation, and about 200 relatives assembled for a special event. They used to be quite frequent and people lived close together. Today you don't have these large assemblages. It's almost all done by telephone. But these people do form units. And the most complete and individual unit is the family. And the family is the place, the little universe, where we have to begin with the Ten Commandments. It is also the place where the Sermon on the Mount is especially valuable. It tells us what we ought to do. We almost nearly all nod our heads in acceptance. Very good. Wonderful.
So when one of these documents says, love thine enemy, there's a moment of pause. Enemies are different. Enemies are something that have hurt us. Now, how did they hurt us? Well, many ways. Perhaps it got the family inheritance away from us. Perhaps they interfered with the marriage and ruined our emotional lives. Or perhaps that they were just ornery or didn't agree with us. Sometimes they made us mad. Sometimes they walked out. Sometimes they said they'd never hope to see us again. Or they sat back somewhere and pouted. So we have all kinds of relatives, those who have relatives are still living. And we have all kinds of descendants if we're old enough to have them. And these descendants and these relatives and these living ancestors are a unit. And our first natural opportunity to grow is to put that unit in order, to get that family into the proper type of situation. Now, of course, you don't always succeed immediately in this kind of a task. You can offer friendship and it may be rejected. You can hope to clear a wound, but the wound may remain open on purpose. These things are hard to work with. And we can't necessarily decide how other people are going to react, but we can decide how we are going to react. And if we have started in to clean house, then the first thing we do is simply absorb, dissolve, and dispose of the animosities which we have built up against anyone or anything. We can say, if it is not best for us, that we do not take part in it. We don't have to follow the paths of those we do not believe in. But we give them a blessing and send them on their way. We do not try to change people who do not want to be changed any more than we want other people to change us when we knew we were right in the first place. So this type of situation goes on and on. So we bless them all, send them on their way, wish them well, and in an emergency we'll do anything that we can for them, even if they don't speak to us. We can close forever the gap in ourselves. We can find that there is something more important than disagreeing with the minds of others, and that is to keep face with the souls of all that live. For somewhere, as a Japanese gentleman observed on one occasion, when he bowed to a well-known criminal, really, he said, why do you bow to a man who has not any integrity? He said, I'm not bowing to the man. I am bowing to the God in the background. That somewhere in this individual is a good soul, no matter how bad he acts. We do not agree with his mistakes. We do not advocate his wrongdoings. But we know that behind all of these things, there is a life struggling to live, a life fighting its own fight, fighting against the weaknesses and intemperances of itself, fighting against its environment and its heredity, fighting against the pressures of circumstances and the temptations of the day. All those who fail in these things have to naturally have trouble. But we still recognize in the background a divinity growing up in the shadow of a great disaster. So all the way along, we try to get rid of all these antagonisms and all these animosities. And we also try to understand the beliefs of other people. This in religion has always been difficult. Religion, while it believes in the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man, has been in the condition of squabbling for the last 5,000 years. It seems almost impossible to get people to have a religion which does them a real good without interfering with the rights of others. Now, religions are necessary. And the beginning of a religion for the individual is the establishment of his own faith on a solid internal foundation. Then the next problem that he has is to live that in the world without interfering with the rights of other people to have their divine relationships. We nearly always find religion impels to conversion. So we try to go out and get other people to think as we do. It's very much like trying to swap recipes over a back fence. The religion which helped our neighbor does not help us, apparently, and vice versa. But therefore, we try to have him take ours, and he tries to have us take his. When both individuals have a religious background, whether they know it or not, that is deeper than either, that goes back to the great basic truths of life. And these basic truths of life, I think, are represented also in the New Testament, where the Master says, "Other sheep have I which are not of this fold." But sometime there will be one fold and one shepherd. So until those days come, we have to serve as we can, always with temperance and understanding. Little by little, we stop making the mistakes which are clearly set forth in the Scriptures, and which, if we make them, continue to impoverish and destroy the consistencies and proprieties of life. As we go along also, we have other problems that come along. And that is that the search for religion is not always an easy one. We notice, of course, that many nations have their own religions. There are the racial religions, national religions, and individual religions. There are faiths that you have to be born into. There are other faiths in which you have to make a voluntary statement of membership. There are others which demand nothing but the expression of certain integrities, certain valuable realities of conduct. But in all of these problems, we are really not working for the idea of trying to convert somebody to our faith. We are trying to lead someone to his own integrities. It is absolutely necessary that the individual decide within himself the quality of his own belief. But if he will quietly and gently and lovingly sit down and think it through, he's going to come out to the same basic convictions that have moved all of the good people of the world. He's going to realize the brotherhood of man, the fatherhood of God, and the sacredness of all living. He's going to find out that it is more blessed to give than to receive. It is more beautiful, more wonderful to love than to be loved. And one of the strongest bonds of all humanity is a sincere friendship, which in many ways is greater than the bonds of birth. These facts become part of life, and most people are going to accept them. They say, "That's true. You're so right." But when the time comes, they go out and live as they did before. These things have not become part of their dedication. They haven't put a discipline upon themselves. So we can go back to the old Pythagorean system and see if we can discipline ourselves through a series of rules over a period of several years, perhaps, in order that we may attain a new relationship with our own integrities. We can take someone's little fault, someone's little mistake that we constantly make and try to correct it. We can decide that there are certain minor situations that arise that can be controlled if we want to control them. We can be a little more thoughtful, a little more kind, and a little more patient by thinking it through. If we have a child that is a little bit troublesome, this becomes an important beginning for a reorganization of relationships. Gradually, by degrees, that child must receive an education that we alone can bestow. You can punish a child forever, and it will go out into society and remain to be punished. But we must not do this. What we really have to do is gradually cause this child to recognize the rightness of certain values. Rightnesses which are valuable because we are practicing themselves. We cannot ask another to be patient and be impatient ourselves. But we can watch the relationship of our own actions to those around us. And where we find some little habit that is obnoxious, some little way of being unpleasant, some little sense of jealousy that keeps crawling out, and see if we can discipline it. Discipline the fact that we are glad that someone else has succeeded instead of wishing it had been us. Glad that other people are happy rather than envying them. Little by little, we can put a discipline upon our own minor moods, just the little things that happen all the time. And gradually out of these disciplines come a dedication, a realization that there is a reason for life that is more important than justifying or satisfying moods, that our values here, that somehow we must achieve. Now, the materialist will probably say, what difference does it make? When you're gone, you're gone. And whether you live well or live badly, it's all alike. Well, even the materialist is wrong to a degree, however, because I know a lot of materialists are a little older and very miserable. This does not mean that the fact that you do not believe in immortality justifies a nasty disposition here and now. Because even the scientist is inclined to believe in a certain hereditary descent, and the nasty disposition that he has is apt to return very strongly in his children and their children. The individual who has no belief and shares this atheism with his progeny is contributing to pain for many generations to come, entirely apart from the religious factor. He is just simply setting bad example. He is depriving individuals of right integrities, and he is failing to educate his children in facts and values which you will not get from school, but which you must get from home. There must be these disciplines, there must be these dedications. Little by little, we can spread a new way of life. We can do things that indicate a certain judgment, a certain integrity. Now, many people, not having had much experience in this, really do not know exactly how to go about it. If, however, they are young and healthy, they will take a course in computerism because they hope to get a job. And they fail to realize that in all probability so many people are doing the same thing that the jobs are going to be very scarce. But the same individual will spend a couple of years on a special trade principle or trying to make a few dollars at something, will not spend 10 minutes improving himself. He will not do anything except that which seems profitable to him in terms of fame, wealth, or office. He is not inclined to practice for 2 or 3 years in a university to learn how to be a decent father or mother. He is just going to do these ordinary things as though they were his natural rights. And if he makes a mess of the whole thing, so what? Others make mess too. This is where we're going along, and this is getting us into the big mess, the mess for which we're not going to find an easy answer unless we start in with ourselves. The idea of trying to convert the world to a code is not very easy because the world has too many codes, and the followers of these codes are clinging desperately to their own beliefs. What we have to do is beyond this, behind it, and above it, and that is to get at the principles. There is no reason why the whole world cannot realize that peace is better than war. There's no reason to believe that there's a large segment of civilization that wishes to destroy other peoples. There is nothing very much except a few very selfish autocratic leaders who are using vast populations simply to advance their own materialistic ambitions. The people suffer. Now, the average individual has no real answer to all this. He's not expected to. The only thing he can do is to learn the lesson that this type of situation brings into focus. He must learn that, in a sense, the way the old Egyptians and Greeks looked at it, this life we live is a kind of initiation. And in the rites of Osiris in Egypt, the rituals were so constituted that the individual in each case was forced to face a danger, a very serious danger, was forced to face something that could prove fatal if he was unable to meet it or was unable to satisfy the demands of the priesthood. But the Egyptian rites were not so terrifying. The candidates were not killed. But a punishment was imposed upon them. If, having started their initiational disciplines, they failed, they then were not allowed to return to the world. They were held in the temples, where they performed various menial duties for the rest of their natural lives. But if they failed partway through an initiation, they could not go back to society, because they knew something which was too dangerous for society to know, but they had failed to demonstrate they knew what to do with it themselves. Now, there's something a little like the consciousness of nuclear fission somewhere lurking in this immoralism. That there are many in this world who know enough to be very dangerous, but do not know enough to know that they must not be dangerous.